Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today is the one and only Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind DanWei.com and my partner in crime here at Cynica. How are you, Jeremy?
Good evening, Kaiser.
Also with us today is Mary Kay Magstad, correspondent for Public Radio International in Beijing. Welcome back, Mary Kay.
Hi, Kaiser.
Today, we're going to talk about the elections in Taiwan, where Kuomintang incumbent Ma Ying-jeou won re-election, defeating the Democratic Progressive Party's Tsai Ing-wen and James C.Y. Sung of the People First Party with more than 51% of the vote. Mary Kay was there reporting from Taiwan, and you can listen to a report on PRI's The World. It was from Monday, is that right? Monday, Jeremy?
Reports on Friday and Monday.
Oh, Friday and Monday, that's right. That's right. I've heard both of them. They're excellent. We're also going to talk about where the internet went this year, just passed. The China Internet Network Information Center, or CNNIC, CINIC, has released its semi-annual report on the development of the internet. We'll also be talking about an influential essay that was written on China Media Project by Hu Yong, a fellow there, talking about trends that he sees on the Chinese internet. But first, we'll plunge in and start talking about the election in Taiwan. Mary Kay, give us some color about the elections from ground level. You were there, and from what I understand, things were very orderly.
Yeah, this was the fourth Taiwanese presidential election I covered,
wow,
and probably the sixth election in Taiwan, including Ma Ying-jeou's mayoral campaign and election. And it was much more low-key than any previous election I'd been to. I mean, if you went to the Kuomintang campaign, they certainly were getting revved up there. But it was very choreographed. They kind of knew how to get revved up, and they were doing it to a certain extent, and then they all went home. And I think it's partly that, you know, Taiwan's democracy is maturing. People are getting used to being able to vote. And in fact, when I went out on the street the day before the election, was talking to 20-something-year-olds, a lot of them said, yeah, I can't really be bothered.
Really?
You know, a decade ago, a lot of people were so passionate about the ability to vote and the need to vote that this by itself already seemed to be sort of a shift in how people are viewed, almost taking for granted the fact that Taiwan is now a democracy.
Huh. Turnout was still high, though.
It was 75%, but low for Taiwan. It was
right.
The lowest Taiwan had in a presidential election.
Enviable. I mean, as an American, I have to say that's an enviable turnout. And I've also heard that there was a real transparency in the election, that you were able to actually watch ballot boxes emptied and votes being counted.
Right, right. And then almost immediately you could see the returns come in, and both the DPP and network television were reporting the returns as they came in. So it became apparent by about 6:30 in the evening, you know, barely an hour and a half after polls had closed, what the outcome was going to be.
That's really remarkable. Now, watching the Taiwan elections from China, both to the extent that they were covered in Chinese media and, I guess, to a certain extent, how they were covered in the U.S., you'd come away with the idea that everything boiled down to the single issue of Taiwan's posture vis-a-vis mainland China. Surely there were other issues that these candidates were campaigning on, or is it essentially accurate to see the whole thing reduced to a referendum on cross-straits policy?
Within Taiwan, it was all about the economy, or mainly about the economy.
Stupid.
Exactly. The Democratic Progressive Party was using that as their campaign issue. You know, look, our economy's been growing. How is it benefiting you, the grassroots people? And you're not seeing enough of that in your paycheck. Why is that? It's because it's going to the elites. If we get into power, we'll make sure that it goes to you.
Why the mismatch, though? I mean, am I wrong in saying that the outside world saw it, as they always do, all about, you know, DPP that's looking for move toward independence and Ma Ying-jeou, who's all about friendlier ties with Beijing?
Well, a number of things have shifted. So the DPP candidate was much more mainstream or middle of the road than her predecessor, Chen Shui-bian, had been. She hasn't really been speaking out strongly for independence for Taiwan. She talks much more about maintaining the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So does Ma Ying-jeou. Now, the Kuomintang party, Ma Ying-jeou's party, has made noises about having some sort of a greater China common market, about having a peace accord with China, and that does make DPP supporters edgy. It even makes some Kuomintang supporters edgy. And in fact, when he suggested this last autumn, there was such an outcry that he backed off and said, of course, I would never do this unless we had a referendum first and the majority of people agreed and also the legislature was behind me.
Right.
So Ma is somewhat constricted in what he can do now that he's been reelected. He's got China pushing him from one side, but he's also got a large percentage of the population, I would say the majority, saying, don't change things too much or too quickly because we're not comfortable with it.
That's right. So economic issues, though, how would you characterize the difference in the approach to Taiwan's economy that the Min Jin Dong and the Kuomintang had?
Well, I think the Kuomintang says, you know, look, we're doing what we can to increase economic growth, and eventually it will trickle down. You know, we're increasing trade with China. We're improving our trade relations with other countries as well. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get a huge bump in your paycheck, that everyone's going to get a huge bump in their paycheck immediately. These things take time. And the DPP is saying, no, we would have more of a social program, social welfare program, so we would get more money to the people who need it, so we could stimulate the economy from the grassroots up.
Right. Jeremy, how would you characterize the way that mainland media, both state-owned and private sector, have covered the Taiwan election?
Well, there were two very different reactions. The official media and the commercial media were very quiet about the elections. There wasn't a lot of reporting. There were some Xinhua official articles about it. One of the Xinhua reports I saw, which had a bit of editorializing in it, emphasized that this was a victory for the 1992 consensus, which nobody else anywhere in the world paid any attention to.
And if I may interject, there is no consensus on what the 1992 consensus is. If you ask mainland China, they'll say it was a consensus that there is one China, it's the People's Republic of China, and Taiwan is a province. If you ask the Taiwanese, they say it's a consensus that we agree to disagree on what one China means. And for us, it might mean that there is one divided China, which may or may not get back together. It might mean that it's the Republic of China that used to be run by Chiang Kai-shek and is now over in Taiwan, but eventually we will take over the rest of the mainland.
Exactly, and I think the important thing about why Xinhua chose the 1992 consensus as the main thrust of their big feature article on it was that they didn't actually have to explain what it was. So they could have 1,000 characters of verbiage and not say diddly squat, essentially.
Right. I mean,
appear to be reporting.
The main characteristic of the so-called 1992 consensus is that it is incredibly ambiguous, and it was left deliberately so. And I think that that's actually genius. I mean, it's
that's a very Chinese kind of genius too,
right,
isn't it?
The best way to move forward is just to sort of let's deal with this later. I mean, you know, Chinese are good at living with ambiguity, right?
Right, indeed. So that was the state-owned media. The commercial media didn't really do anything interesting. Where there was interesting commentary was on the internet, and obviously a lot of it on our favorite channel for finding angry, dissatisfied, or otherwise engaged Chinese youths, etc., is Weibo. So on the Chinese internet, there was a fair bit of discussion about it, and quite a lot of it was very positive, and quite a lot of it took the tone that, look, Chinese people can have democracy. There were people circulating a Mao Zedong quote given in 1945 to some foreign journalists about how the new China will be democratic. There were jokes being circulated about, for example, how, you know, Taiwan is backward because in Taiwan, when you have an election today, you know the answer who wins tomorrow. Whereas in China, if we have a leadership change next year, we already know the result.
I have a couple of choice quotes. These come to us courtesy of Shanghaiist. Here's what the author Mu Rongxue-Cun said. If it's all at all possible to assign scores for democracy, then today's Taiwan is probably a lot more democratic than many of the more established democracies of the world. These people are like you and I, yellow-skinned, brown-eyed, speak Mandarin, and eat Chinese food. Those people that think democracy is not suitable for the Chinese people can now shut up. Those people that say democracy is not possible because the Chinese people are not well-educated enough or that China is too unique for it can now shut up. Those people that are still going on about how socialism is superior, please either go to North Korea for a taste of real socialism or shut up. And this is sort of characteristic. I mean, one of the other clever ones was from an author named Qin Biaoxi. When I saw Sinopec's 12 million RMB chandelier, I was not jealous. When I saw Guo Mei Mei's Maserati, I was not jealous. When I saw the 3,000 square meter luxury apartment bought by the former chief engineer Zhou Shuguang of the Ministry of Railways in the U.S., I was not jealous. When I saw the former Ministry of Railways Liu Zhijun had been sleeping with actresses from Dream of the Red Mansion, I was not jealous. When I saw the son of an official trample upon the law saying, "My dad is Li Gang," I was not jealous. When I saw the people of Taiwan elect their own president under a one-man, one-vote system, I was jealous. So this is just sort of a taste of the sorts of stuff that we saw. Do you think that this has significantly impacted, Jeremy, the popular discourse on democracy in China?
Yes. I think, you know, it's not an isolated incident. Obviously, China is changing and there's a lot more discussion of this kind of thing. And, you know, just recently we've been talking on this podcast about Han Han and his three essays on democracy, revolution, and freedom. So it's not that the subject hasn't been broached on the internet before, but it certainly did. There was a spike in such discussion. And I think, you know, if you look at, I mean, for example, those tweets that you just read out, those people, they may be influential to a minority in China, but they are influential to an important minority.
Right. I read with interest Jeremiah Jenny, who's a frequent guest on this show. He had written a blog in which he sort of invokes Sun Zhongshan, Sun Yat-sen, and Han Han as examples of prominent Chinese who, though separated by a century, essentially made the same argument, that is, that, you know, the political consciousness of Chinese is somehow not up to shouldering the responsibilities required of a citizen in a democracy. How do you feel about it? Do you think that that argument is now, is this a nail in its coffin, or the nail?
No, I don't think it is, because, I mean, Chinese people themselves have double standards about what goes on in China and, you know, in the PRC and elsewhere. I mean, just there was another thing, excuse me, from Weibo that was circulating the other day.
Okay, we're going to officially not the 2012, no more apologizing for criticism
okay.
from Weibo.
Okay, so this thing from Weibo, it was a joke that's been circulating. Somebody tweeted, I was just in Pudong Airport in Shanghai, arrivals hall, and I heard this mother say to her screaming child, stop screaming, we're back in China now so I can hit you.
That's cute. That's cute. I guess another question that I have is, let's go back and talk about democracy, and I think I have a lot of thoughts on this, but before we do, I wanted to put a question to Mary Kay. Do you think that this has affected the way that people think about the issue of Taiwan independence? Was this even something that you saw being talked about, or is this something that nobody dares broach even on Weibo?
Well, a couple of comments. First of all, the majority of Taiwanese now think of themselves as being Taiwanese rather than Chinese.
Sure.
Which doesn't mean that
Hong Kong too, right?
Yes, exactly. Right. Which doesn't mean that they don't want to have interaction with China. It doesn't mean that they don't embrace their Chinese heritage. It means that they think of themselves as a separate entity and they want to retain that autonomy. Secondly, when I was in Taiwan, one of the things I did was go to a classroom where Wang Dan was teaching a group of students, including mainland Chinese students.
Wang Dan, for anyone who doesn't remember, was one of the leading student activists in 1989, and he later on went on to Harvard and is now teaching in Taiwan, right?
Right. So he gave this impassioned three-hour lecture on why democracy is not inappropriate for Chinese. And among the students, the mainland students who were there, many of them asked some pretty interesting, tough questions and afterwards said, you know, it's interesting. When I came here, you know, I was just kind of interested in what this Tiananmen dissident was all about. You know, I'd heard a little bit about it, probably not until I was in college, but, you know. And it turns out, you know, he's actually got some really interesting things to say. But now that I'm in Taiwan and I see what the Taiwanese are like and I see what's important to them and how different they are from, you know, how we live in mainland China, not necessarily from individual mainlanders, but just the general culture. Mm-hmm. You know, the people, in fact, one student, a 22-year-old engineering student from Fujian said to me, you know, I mean, they just seem much more considerate of each other. They seem to have more of a sense of society. And I said, so, you know, what do you think about Taiwan and mainland China reuniting? And he's like, yeah, I'm not so sure that's going to happen.
This is someone who's been in Taiwan. I'm asking more, though, about mainlanders. I mean, how are mainlanders feeling like, I mean, if, as we've suggested, they've seen this as sort of a referendum in many ways on the subject of Taiwan independence, are any of them that you've seen willing to tackle this topic?
I haven't seen anything about that.
And I'm not sure.
I didn't look, but I haven't seen anything about that.
I'm not sure it was a referendum on Taiwan independence,
right.
This one in particular, because it just wasn't being stressed.
I'm just saying that this, from the Chinese perspective, any election in Taiwan is always going to be a referendum, essentially, on attitudes toward independence. And people breathe a collective sigh of relief, or those who oppose it. They may embrace the idea of democracy, but I think that they are more happy to crow about it, or to sing its praises when the result is a Kuomintang victory.
Right. But Perhaps as more people are online and more people have actual direct interactions with Taiwan, either from going there as tourists or from studying there, whatever, they recognize that actually there are more issues for Taiwanese than just what your relationship is with China, as with any other country.
Mm. Before we move to the next topic, I really do want to talk a little bit more about this whole, suzhi argument, about this, the culture argument that Chinese are somehow not ready for democracy. It strikes me that, I mean, while I find that the straw man version of that argument, I find to be contemptible.
Suzhir, you have to explain.
Suzhir, right. I mean, we've talked about it a lot. It's this Chinese word that's difficult to translate, which, you know, some people have said is character or cultivation.
Or refinement or
breeding, character.
But
breeding.
There's also something like integrity in there.
Yeah, there's elements of virtue and integrity in there. But
The quality of a person.
Right.
Right, but if you say low-quality person, it doesn't translate well in English.
No. Someone who doesn't behave well is uncivilized.
Right, somebody who cuts in line and doesn't dim their brights when they're driving on the road.
Yeah, the level of consideration is in there too.
Yeah, sure. Right. So Suzhir, I mean, the idea, I mean, this is something that Jackie Chan talked about a few years ago, I mean, he, implicitly at least, at the Boao Forum. This is something that Han Han actually talks about quite explicitly in those essays. But I'm not convinced that what they're really saying is that there's something intrinsic, culturally intrinsic to Chinese. I mean, there were, I think, earlier iterations of this. We were talking before the show about ex-Singaporean President Lee Kuan Yew had to say about this,
Asian values,
right. And maybe he was at that point saying that there's something intrinsic, something is sort of inextricably Confucian about this that is inimical to democracy. My personal belief, though, is that can we assume that an island of, 25 million people can be governed in essentially the same way? I mean, 25 million is a rounding error that we often leave out. When we say 1.3 billion instead of 1.34 billion, that 0.4 billion that we're leaving off is, I'm sorry, 0.04 billion is significantly larger than the entire population of Taiwan.
Hmm.
So it's something of a rounding error. And to imagine that stability can scale like that, I think we need to actually at least examine that assumption. And I don't see that happening in conversations. I don't see that we're Chinese, Chinese.
But I think you're being a little bit too – I don't think it's a straw man. I think there is an argument that you see in Chinese and even in English reporting and thinking about Chinese democracy, which is that it somehow isn't suitable for East Asia, for Chinese. I think you do see that argument. I don't think that's a straw man.
I think it's usually said at this stage. And the implicit in that is that China can develop in that direction, that the suzhi increases as the economy improves.
I know anecdote is not data, but the week before this election in Taiwan, I took a British film crew with their Chinese organizer, producer person, who's somebody who works with Western media, is very open-minded. During the trip, one of the British journalists asked her, so can you have democracy in China? And she said, no, it'll be chaos. Look at Taiwan, how they fight in the parliament.
Right, not so much lately, though.
No, they haven't.
No, not so much. And I think one of the things about this election that was interesting was people were observing that it was orderly. And I do think that there is a strain of thinking in China that Chinese people just can't do it. Look, they'll punch each other up in the parliament. And I think that if there has been an effect on certain intellectuals, it's been to look at this and think, wow, nobody shot anybody. There were no punch-ups in the street.
No,
it was an orderly election. And I think there is a new thing there.
Mary Kay, you were just talking earlier before we started recording about a conversation you just had before coming over with a young woman.
Right, with a young Chinese friend in her early to mid-20s who looked with great interest at the Taiwanese election but said, yeah, I just don't think China's ready. I don't think Chinese are ready for democracy. And when I asked her why, she's like, well, you look at how low the suzhi is. You look at how people don't really think about themselves as being part of a society. They don't think of their responsibilities to society. So, then how would people, be thinking about these bigger issues when they go to vote?
And I'm going to say that's a very common attitude. I mean, so many of the people that I've talked to about this, they look very admiringly at what's happened in Taiwan. But they still see it as, you know, a significant distance between where we are, point A, and where we want to be, point B. And they're not always really sanguine about the ability to march quickly in a straight line toward that. I think that most of them still think that culture, the suzhou, is sort of determined in many ways by wealth, by economic conditions in the country. They've bought this argument for an awfully long time.
And bought the argument is the right way to say it, because from the time they've entered the classroom, they've been told.
Right.
This isn't appropriate for Chinese people. This, you know, our society runs better the way it is. A couple of things. You know, if you look at the per capita income of Indonesia or India, I would say that it's probably around the same or lower than China's,
sure.
And yet they manage. And Indonesia went through its transformation to democracy relatively peacefully 13 years ago. India, you can look at it and say, okay, it's kind of a mess, but there's still a way to work out problems. And when one party wins the election, the other stands back and says, okay, it's yours.
Indonesia is a particularly compelling example for China. I mean, you can't really argue with that.
And the other thing I wanted to pick up on that you said is, you know, in terms of income level, there's a Harvard professor, Dwight Perkins, who did a study of at what income level over time in different countries the middle class started pushing for more civil rights and ultimately for some level of democracy. And it was at about 13,000 in 2000, I think it was $2,008. $13,000 a year.
That high?
That high.
We're so far from that. That's
depressing. Purchasing power parity.
Okay.
So actually, Beijing and Shanghai aren't that far from that.
Right.
You know, the rest of China, yes. But when you think about who's online, I mean, this week China crossed the line into having more people living in cities than in the countryside, 500 million people online. The Taiwan elections are getting attention now in a way that they didn't 4 years ago. There just weren't as many people online who were interested in this issue.
Yeah,
I think also you are actually seeing that effect already happening in Chinese cities. I mean, for example, the air pollution, the PM2.5 explosion of interest amongst Chinese people in the last year is, I think, it's an early sign of that.
Just to make sure, I mean, I'm really not advancing my own position here. I think I am contemptuous of the argument that there's some, you know, political cultural barrier that mainland China faces that Taiwan didn't, or that, you know, that there is necessarily some economic threshold that needs to be crossed before democracy can be considered. So
And one other thing.
Do you mean you still believe in democracy?
I do,
despite your home country being such a mess. Both of you, sorry. That is one of the less inspiring elections that we're reading about at the moment.
One other thing related to democracy in China and Taiwan that China's leaders might want to keep in mind as they're looking across the strait, and that is that when Taiwan ended martial law and started allowing freedom of speech and started allowing people to have free access to information, innovation took off. China's been talking about and working hard to get to the goal of having a more innovative society, a more innovative economy, and they know they need to move in that direction, you know, if they want to have sustained long-term economic growth. And they're coming across this obstacle they've put in their own path.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more there. Let's move on and talk about our next topic, which is internet trends for the year 2011. The China Internet Network Information Center, CINIC, not to be confused with our podcast, CINICA, released its 29th China Internet Development Statistical Report on Monday. You can actually download the whole thing in Chinese. They put it out in English, but it usually doesn't come out for what?
Doesn't always come out in English. In fact, they've been getting lazy about their English. Many times they only put out one English report a year, and the other one they just
do
Chinese.
Well, if they do, it'll be the end of the year one, right? So
yeah, it should be this one.
We can anticipate. But in the meantime, people can look at beat.baidu.com, where I've written up a little summary of some of the overall stats and some of the directions. First, you know, the top line number was 513 million internet users in China.
Yay! We've passed half a billion.
Right.
Rock and roll.
That's still only 38% of the population, right? Which is actually, I mean, just by comparison, internet penetration in major Chinese cities is hovering near 70%. So we're talking about Beijing, which has the highest penetration, and followed by Shanghai, and then Guangzhou and Shenzhen.
And that's about the same as in the U.S.
That's right. It's not quite to where the U.S. is. The U.S. is over 75%, and countries like South Korea are over 80% or right around 80%. Still, this is pretty remarkable. Some people would challenge the methodology. They say the 60,000 people that they polled in this, all you only needed to be someone over the age of six who at some point in the last 6 months has been online to qualify as an internet user. So that may be kind of a loose definition for what it is. But then I look at the number of people who are using services like Weibo, which is the other really remarkable statistic in that batch. Weibo had increased over the year by 296%. In other words, it tripled, right? Which is just really remarkable. Nearly half of Chinese netizens now of that total number, that we're talking 48.7% of all Chinese netizens are using Weibo. Jeremy, I don't think we were wrong last week when we talked about 2011 being
the year of Weibo. Yes. No, absolutely not. Yeah. Confirmed by Cynic.
Yes.
And, you know, you can question their statistics, but they've been putting out data sets twice a year for the last decade based on the same methodology. So, okay, maybe
they did change at
there
one
are
point,
only 450
right.
million internet users, or maybe there are actually 700 million, or maybe there are only 300 million. But, I mean, basically the trend lines are clear. And I think it's reasonable to take their numbers at face value with just a small pinch of salt in your pocket.
Right. I think there's an interesting phenomenon whereby people in the outside world, people who aren't familiar with China, imagine that, you know, in Lachman Tse's memorable phrase, this great firewall of China is sort of an Iron Curtain 2.0, and that they imagine that we're all sort of shuffling around here on a very limited number of internet sites because of censorship.
Kind of like the North Koreans.
Right, the North Koreans do, right.
Like the North Koreans actually do.
Actually do, right. And, of course, the fact is that it's an incredibly vibrant, really dynamic, you know, internet ecosystem here. The number of websites, 2.3 million websites now, which is a significant bounce back from last year, where the number had actually fallen considerably, was down to 1.9 million. It had been 3.23 million in 2009. They implemented all these new registration requirements for people who registered websites, and now it's back. I mean, we're trending upward again. 2.3 million websites. Jeremy, did anything else jump out at you that you thought was really interesting?
Mobile, I think, is what is it? More than 300 million?
Yeah, 356 million is what they're saying.
And I think this is
people that's accessing the internet via a mobile device.
Via a mobile device, and I think this is the next big thing because you're now seeing smartphones that cost less than 1,000 yuan.
That's right,
which is truly remarkable.
Didn't Pan Shiyi put those up?
That was an inside joke.
Right?
Yeah. You have to be a really dorky follower of China news to get that. Rural areas, people are going to start using mobile phones to get online.
That's right.
Everybody is going to be on the internet if they have a phone. And there are more than 800 million cell phone users in China.
Over 900 million. And 100 million smartphones already out there.
Yeah.
And that number is growing very, very fast.
And I mean, the great thing about Chinese attitude towards intellectual property is that basically very high-end smartphones are going to be very, very cheap in the next few years.
Right.
So it's not going to make much
difference
if you buy like an old-fashioned, what they used to call feature phone. Or if you buy a smartphone, it's going to be the same cost. So if you are a really poor peasant in the middle of Anhui and you buy a phone, chances are you'll buy a mobile phone that has a smartphone, I mean, that has internet capability.
So statistics aside, though, I mean, how did your internet use habits change over the last year? I mean, not that we're representative of Chinese users. I mean, maybe more so, but I mean, we'll certainly spend a lot more time with SNS, or I mean, specifically with Weibo, not with the SNS.
Weibo and Twitter, yeah. I had to finally truly recognize that I'm completely hooked on Twitter and Weibo, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Mary, you're not on Twitter, are you?
I am on Twitter.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't tweet a lot,
You don't
though.
Tweet a lot. No,
every couple of days.
What's your, just for people who want to follow you, just Mary Kay, all one word?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Okay.
If I can jump in, though, with what you were saying about farmers getting smartphones, I might have said this on a previous Seneca podcast, but it was months ago, so I'll say it again. there was this coal miner who I met in Shanxi province who was dying of black lung disease. He'd been in an illegal coal mine. He worked for 2 months and he was already too sick to continue to work. He was going to be dead in 3 years at the most. And he was trying to get compensation from the mine for his family. And the mine owners and the local government, which had, you know, sort of a stake in the mine, beat up his wife, actually, when she came in asking for the compensation.
Assholes.
And you know, he was just left coughing and not able to pay his medical bills. He had not even a 1,000 kwai smartphone, but like a 300 kwai fake smartphone, which he used to tweet or to he used Weibo and sent out basically a
distress
call. The story of his, of what had happened with him. And Chinese journalists picked up on his story and wrote about it. It put pressure on the local government and on the mine owners, and he ended up getting the compensation. He also ended up getting a lot of donations from people who read the story, to the point that when I interviewed him, he said, you know, actually, we don't really need any more donations now. We have enough money to send my kids to school.
That is a perfect segue, I mean, into the other part of this conversation that I wanted to have, which is talking about this piece that China Media Project fellow Hu Yong wrote on that excellent website that we all read, the Hong Kong China Media Project, talking about three internet trends, the second of which was specifically this. It was essentially the empowerment of internet users. It was just a theme that we've talked about many, many, many times on here on Seneca. The other two that he talked about, I think there's really no arguing that first, right? The other two were that nationalism online has somewhat abated and that things are moving more in the direction of social concern, that people are more wrapped up with issues of social justice now. What do you think of that contention? Do you see the nationalists sort of receding online?
I think it's very true. But it doesn't mean they won't come back. I think the sort of news flow has a big impact on it.
Yeah, there weren't flashpoints. I mean, where were the flashpoints? There wasn't a major Sino-Japanese incident. I mean, the last one, the fishing boat captain was in 2010, not in 2011.
But also, I wonder if the zeitgeist is a bit different now than it was in 2007, 2008, where there was this pride in an ascendant China and irritation at anyone who got in the way of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly you just don't want us to succeed. So screw you. Whereas now I think people are more looking around and saying, no, we expect better than this. We expect better than this for ourselves from our government.
There's a blend, though. I mean, we have this tendency, sure. I think, to
say one or the other.
Right. You're either a nationalist or you're something. I mean, that everyone sort of exists on this continuum between, you know, liberal pro-Western Democrats and these angry, strident nationalists. And you can sort of apply. I think that most people, that it's a Cartesian axis.
I think it's just like
above.
The United States. You have everything. But I think there are times, you know, for example, I mean, I used to follow right-wing American blogs and websites very closely because I just found it fascinating. And in the early years of the Iraq War, there was this very, very strong online movement that attracted people who weren't previously conservative or right-wing.
Sure.
A great example of this is the Little Green Football's website. A guy who was a liberal kind of musician became one of those post 9/11 hawks. And for a few years, his website was a gathering point for a lot of, you know, people who hated Muslims and were really, really hawkish. And he changed again and got into a fight with some of the other right-wing, the more extreme right-wing types, and has been going gradually and sometimes more quickly back towards the center. In China, an equivalent might be anti-CNN.com, which became famous in the Olympic year for exposing evil Western media, cropping photos and doing things like that. Now, anti-CNN.com has now morphed into m4.cn, I think, April, Suyue, Meiti. And although they still do have a lot of nationalistic stuff, it's balanced by a much cooler and more cosmopolitan view of China and its place in the world.
Right. I think that one example I can think of that illustrates this interesting blend is the Weibo reaction to the Russian embassy starting its own Twitter feed. Do you guys remember this? It was just a couple of months ago. This is something that a lot of people wrote on at the time. The Russian embassy started its feed, and immediately people started attacking it. But often out of the same critic would come a line of attack that was essentially nationalistic,
the Russians stole our land. You know, they appropriated huge pieces of what was, you know, once China, and broke off Mongolia, which was properly ours. And, you know, again, like I said, out of the same feed, stuff that would come from the liberal tradition, which was, you know, you subjected us to Marxism-Leninism. I mean, it's your fault that we're not a democracy, which is, I thought was really interesting. I mean, it's this blend of liberalism and nationalism that I think that people have a little bit of trouble wrapping their heads around.
And what's interesting about having those sorts of comments stay online is, as our listeners in China know, those outside may or may not know, a lot of comments that are obviously anti-system are taken off immediately. Those that are pro-system are put on deliberately quite often. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're genuinely felt. Sometimes they're paid to put them on.
Interesting. The other claim that he made, the third thing that he said, was that the Chinese government, you know, to segue off of what you just said about paid comments, has really fallen behind in its mastery of this new networked world. They don't understand the internet and are unable to respond with sufficient alacrity to changes that are happening in public opinion online. They're not able to manage it. They've lost control, essentially. Do you feel like that was a trend that you noticed in the year? Or is it sort of just following the same trend line?
I don't know. I mean, I still think the Communist Party is doing a pretty good job of nailing Jell-O to the wall, in Bill Clinton's memorable phrase. But certainly you can talk about things in public on the internet that you just could not talk about in public in China a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think about the conversation that Han Han's essays generated, you know, about democracy.
Quite remarkable.
Really remarkable. So is that a loss of control, or is this a deliberate sort of safety valve release, as we've suggested in the past?
I don't think it was a planned safety valve. And I think they're trying to do the best job right now that they can of both controlling it and making it appear to be a very smart thing. Certainly the movement to control it is still very strong right now. And, you know, this has been another week when there have been further stories in the media about real name registration requirements for Weibo and other websites.
But one move that was sort of tangentially related, where I thought, okay, now they've lost the plot, was when they started limiting the amount of entertainment programming that could be shown on television. It's yeah. Like, do you not realize that young people also can watch anything they want to on the internet?
Yeah.
At least those who can jump the wall.
Yeah.
To jump the wall to do it. I mean, it's there on all of the... Right.
I mean, if you compare to, like, the United States, where now they're the anti-SOPA and PIPA protests, right? Mm-hmm. It's basically the same problem. It's just that in the United States, it's a bunch of old capitalists who have no clue about the internet. And here we have a bunch of old communists who have no clue about the internet.
And so they think that if they limit what people can see on television, they will affect how people think.
Oh. But I mean, Jeremy, are you saying that they have no clue, or that they're very, you know, good and supple, and they've exhibited, you know, jello nailing?
No, I think they have been very good at nailing Jell-O to the wall. But I mean, some of the things
that's just
that happen,
you know, brute
in China,
force, right?
Certainly, I think SAFT, the State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television, which is responsible for the rules to limit reality TV and entertainment on Chinese TV, they are not in touch with the internet. They have no clue. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a different group of people from the people controlling the internet.
Right, it isn't
They're single. Both following the same, the current spirit of Hu Jintao, which is, you know, find a way to strangle everything interesting. they're following the spirit, but they're doing it in different ways, and SAFT are out of touch.
And try to get people to think the way we want them to think. But mm-hmm. on that count, I think they're not necessarily successfully nailed.
No, they're completely out of touch. But I mean, the real name requirement is something that even just threats of it are going to make people perhaps think a little bit more carefully about posting things.
Going back to this first assertion that nationalism is in decline, I don't know if you guys got a chance to read something. I sent you a link to it earlier. An Australian scholar by the name of James. I don't know if he's actually Australian himself, but he teaches in Australia. James Leibold, I'm going to say. Leibold.
That was actually going to be my recommendation for this week, that James Leibold piece.
China beat piece. He talks about the dark side of the Chinese internet. A lot of it is very anecdotal. He talks about his own experiences on a stridently nationalist website. Actually, it's not just nationalist. It's sort of this racist website, this sort of great Han chauvinist website called what?
Hanwang, I think.
Yeah, Hanwang. Yeah. Hanwang, yeah. Right.
The Han.
Which has what? How many?
Lots of people.
3 million, I think. I'm going to say
3 million. 3 million people visit each month, unique users.
Right, which is, you know, pretty impressive number.
And up to 7 million sometimes, like I think it was April 2010.
Wow. And I guess he got in a big brush with these folks over his criticism, or his praise for the book Wolf Totem, in which he's being depicted as somebody who champions these, you know, savage nomadic people over the civilized Han, which of course is unacceptable to these
guys. Wolf Totem is a novel that takes place in Mongolia. And,
I think we've talked about Wolf Totem on this show before.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I thought it was a very good read, and I think it's something that we've all experienced in some way or another. I mean, having had run-ins with the rabid nationalist types. I'm not sure it's in retreat. I think that it has found darker corners to inhabit, maybe. The BBSs, certainly, which don't get a lot of attention these days because everyone is so focused on Weibo. I mean, I'll say it again. I think Weibo has a particular ideological bent to it. I mean, it from the very early times, because Sina was a sort of news-focused blog or a website, a portal to begin with, it tended to attract a lot of liberal intellectuals, and Weibo's first, you know, power users were really sort of the liberal intellectual crowd, the rightists, as it were, and they tended not to, I mean, to turn their noses up a little bit at nationalists, who are still there in huge numbers. I think if you look at, you know, any of the Tianya sections or on Baidu Tieba, there's still plenty of it.
But this is just a sign of perhaps of China becoming a more normal country. I mean, America has those same people. France has those same people. They never go away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that he singled this out. He said that it's in retreat. Like that. I think that it's simply that it was an absence of major flashpoints around which to rally.
I don't agree with you there. I think he has a point. I think that.
I hope he's right.
I think that more people are focused on their own lives and why the fuck didn't I get a raise this year and that douchebag has just, you know, sprayed mud on me with his Lamborghini. I mean, I think that those are the issues that are exciting people right now in China. It's not, you know, like, we Chinese and why aren't we respected? People are like, I'm just a, you know, there's this word on the internet, Pimin. It means like, you know, buttocks people. I mean, it basically means you're an ordinary person and you get fucked with on a daily basis. The Pimin have had enough. And they don't need, you know, the right now is not a mood in China where cheap nationalism is going to satisfy them.
Okay. Let's move on and deal with our recommendations. Jeremy, I think I've already just sort of scooped yours. I'm sorry.
But I do have another one quickly, which is the Zhongnanhai blog had a few days ago an interesting post about this question that's been in the news of Hong Kong Chinese people, do they feel Chinese or not? And in this post, he looks at, you know, why a lot of Hong Kongers historically and currently feel very alienated from the mainland. And there are a lot of Hong Kong Chinese have commented in English on this post. So I think that's Zhongnanhai blog.
The blogger's name is Callum
McLeod.
Terrific post, though. Yeah, it was really an enjoyable post. It's very intelligent. And apparently he's getting thousands of hits a day. He was just complaining on Twitter before I left the office, saying that he feels like he's not going to be able to follow this up with anything decent now. So yeah, the Zhongnanhai blog, this post on Hong Kong identity about the controversy from
Hong Kong attitudes to the mainland and mainland
right,
people,
which seem to be
say.
Trending away from identifying as Chinese and rather identifying as Hong Kong, and this sent Chinese leadership into apoplexy.
Mary Kay,
you got
my apologies. I forgot to bring a recommendation.
Oh, she didn't do her homework today. I mean, I'll give you one of mine. I think I have two of them. Kind of, they're kind of related. They are both infographic related. One is for all you hardcore China economics geeks out there, the China Econ Tracker at the China Real-Time blog by the Wall Street Journal. It's really good. It looks at all manner of statistics. The only thing that it doesn't really have retail sales. Well, maybe if you guys are listening, you can add that to it.
Also sourcing please.
Right, sourcing.
Wall Street Journal. What are your sources? You don't make it very clear where you're getting these numbers from, and that makes me think you're being a little bit like the Chinese government. but it's good.
Related to this, as I was when that broke, somebody who follows me on Twitter sent me a link to a packet of terrific infographics that they're going to update very soon. It's really, really visually quite beautiful. The website that this guy recommended is Business Forum, that's one word, -china.com. Businessforumchina.com. It's businessforum-china.com, which has, you can click on the infographics tab, a bunch of very interesting charts, and they put out a PDF with a whole bunch of things, really, like I said, visually quite compelling and quite up to date. And this does actually include, I think, retail and is very well sourced. It shows most of these come from the National Bureau of Statistics or from, if you can call that well sourced. Anyway, Mary Kay, next time you'll do your homework. I mean, we're going to have
I
you back.
I forgot about the homework.
Yeah, sorry
about that. It's been a while since I was last here.
Okay, well, you're going to be here next time on Tuesday after or Thursday after the Chinese New Year's holiday. I want to, on behalf of all of us here at Seneca, I want to wish everyone a very happy Chinese New Year, welcoming the Year of the Dragon.
Yeah, and let's say good riddance to the Year of the Bunny, which started with that memorable animation by the Quang Quang people.
That was a great yeah. video, though.
So now it's the Year of the Water Dragon.
Uh-huh. Well, anyway, happy Year of the Water Dragon to all of you from...
yeah, we pronounce it water.
Right. Thanks, Mary Kay.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time. And Jeremy, thanks again, as always. See you next time on the Seneca Podcast. Bye-bye.